With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details. With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
The Gone Cold podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
When Helen and Bud Burton traveled 100 miles from Breckenridge, Texas, to Arlington to cheer on their baseball team, the Texas Rangers, on the evening of September 8, 1981, they left their two children, 10-year-old Jason and 3-year-old Ryan, under the care of a trusted friend. Ryan and Jason's 12-year-old babysitter, Tina, put them to bed and dozed off on the living room sofa. Tina heard a door shut and what sounded like a baby whimpering in the dead of night, and after checking out the house, nothing seemed amiss. When she woke up the following morning, however, the front door was open, and 3-year-old Ryan was gone. Around 3,000 Breckenridge residents joined the search for the missing girl, nearly half the population of the town. But after extensive and thorough search efforts of nearly every brushy field, thicket, creek bed, and abandoned structure, Ryan could not be found. Police believed someone entered the Burton home and took Ryan directly from her crib, sneaking past Tina both ways. As strange as it sounded, especially for a town with almost no violent crime, it was also the only scenario that made sense. As the weeks, months, and years went on, Bud and Helen Burton did everything they could think of to progress the investigation and keep Ryan's name and picture in the media. Still, the many tips the Breckenridge police received led nowhere. The Burtons joined forces with John and Reve Walsh, whose 6-year-old son Adam was kidnapped from a mall in Hollywood, Florida, and brutally slain. Together with other families of missing and murdered children, they lobbied the United States Congress for legislation called the Missing Children's Assistance Act of 1983. Which offered at least some federal assistance and resources to local agencies dealing with abducted kids. In October of 1983, a television movie about John Walsh's son, titled simply Adam, was seen by 38 million folks across the nation. During the program, the organization Child Find showed photographs of 50 missing children in hopes to generate new leads on the cases. One of those was little Nicole Ryan Burton, and tons of leads were produced as a result. None panned out. But after the rebroadcast of the movie on April 30th, 1984, something new did come, and Ryan's parents were once again hopeful that their little girl was alive. In May of 1984, it came to light that the FBI had been searching for a man and a woman in their investigation of the Ryan Nicole Burton case. After their efforts had failed, the Bureau released a description of the couple through newspaper and television news sources. The pair was believed to be traveling with the 3-year-old missing girl, and with the news and descriptions also came the backstory of how this man and woman got on the radar in the first place. In mid-April, a 12-year-old girl in Dallas, Texas, was finally taken seriously after repeatedly insisting that Ryan had been her little playmate at a Mesquite daycare center during 1982. The girl had seen Ryan's photograph on two television shows, one in November of 1982 and another in February of 1983. Both times, this 12-year-old told her mother that Ryan, the photo on the television, attended the Mesquite daycare, and her memory of the missing girl was so ingrained and vivid because she would only play with her. Finally, at her daughter's persistence on the issue, the mother called the FBI's hotline and reported it. Several other witnesses in Dallas, too, were questioned and even underwent hypnosis regarding this tip. All witness accounts and descriptions, it should be noted, were given a year and a half after the couple and child were seen. Though FBI agent Bill Weishaupt insisted that someone who knew the Burton family was involved in Ryan's abduction, neither Bud nor Helen Burton recognized the description of the couple or the composite sketches. Regardless, the Burtons told reporters their faith and hope was renewed that they'd have their daughter back. The suspected abductors of 3-year-old Ryan Burton were thought to still be somewhere in the Southwest and were described as follows. These suspects were called lower middle class transients who moved from town to town to avoid detection, the man likely taking various jobs in carpentry and construction. They were thought to have been living out of their vehicle, which was thought to be a red 1977 Ford Mustang. Possibly Colorado license plates. The passenger side door of the car is dented, and on the upper driver's side of the windshield was spiderweb cracks. The male suspect is thin, around 5 feet 11 inches tall, with long, straight, dark hair and pink acne scars, along with a mole on his right cheek and scar above his right eyebrow. His index, middle finger, and thumb were stained by heavy cigarette smoking, the descriptions read. The FBI determined the woman would wash the child's hair in gas station restroom sinks from time to time in order to keep up a clean, neat appearance. The woman was described as in her 20s, 5 feet 6 inches tall, about 120 pounds, with long, straight, dark blonde hair. She rarely wears makeup or jewelry, says the description. For the first time, the description of blonde-haired, blue-eyed Ryan Nicole Burton included a mention of a light-colored birthmark under her right shoulder blade. She'd have been almost 6 years old at this time. After releasing the descriptions of the couple to the media on Tuesday, May 9, 1984, a man who'd seen a little girl accompanied by a woman matching the composite sketch and description at a fast food restaurant near Sweetwater, Texas, phoned authorities. The woman was subsequently stopped on Interstate 20. After questioning and taking fingerprints from the woman and the footprints of the little girl, Dallas FBI agent Joe Hursley said that although they would fully investigate this lead, it appeared as if the entire scenario concerning the couple and the little girl had absolutely nothing to do with Ryan Burton's missing persons case. And it didn't. The investigation was back at square one. For a law enforcement agency who once told Helen Burton that she watched too much television, the FBI putting so much stock in this story is interesting. But authorities remain steadfast in their belief that Ryan was still alive. At least, that's what they were saying. The following month, they discovered otherwise. In 1984, the Missing Children's Assistance Act was passed by the United States Congress, allowing for the formation of something akin to Child Find 2.0, called the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, more commonly referred to as NCMEC, perhaps. The organization was formed by many children's advocates, including Revay and John Walsh. Likely everyone listening to this right now knows exactly what NCMEC is and what it does, and maybe we take for granted the importance of the organization, since it's difficult to remember a time when NCMEC wasn't there. But before 1984, nothing like it existed at this scale. besides that the goal was to protect children. Perhaps the most persuasive argument leading to the creation of NCMEC was a simple one. Local, state, and federal police had established resources and databases that could track everything from stolen vehicles to stolen guns through the FBI's National Crime Computer. Proponents of the Missing Children's Assistance Act argued, why isn't there such a thing for missing and victimized children? So, with the passage of that act came NCMEC, a resource center and clearinghouse to help families and police locate missing kids and provide ways to prevent sexual abuse, kidnapping, and other forms of child victimization and exploitation. A 24-hour toll-free hotline was also introduced, 1-800-THE-LOST. The launch of NCMEC was about as big a deal as they come, and parents the nation over certainly celebrated its creation. On June 13, 1984, President Ronald Reagan held a ceremony at the White House to draw attention to the center's opening. And in Breckenridge, Helen and Bud Burton were likely filled with renewed optimism and hope that NCMEC's launch would help them get their little girl back. The very next day, however, fate chose cruelty.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kid's PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
On Thursday, June 14th, 1984, on a dirt road on the outskirts of far west Breckenridge, Texas, a man's dog got loose. The man began chasing the canine through a fenced-in rural pasture behind Breckenridge Country Club's golf course, about 1 mile south of U.S. Highway 180. As he ran, he stumbled over something. When he glanced back to see what he had almost tripped on, he saw the half-buried skeletal remains of a child. A stone wall prevented any passersby from seeing the shallow grave. The man hurried to the nearest phone to call the Breckenridge police. Mayor Lloyd Mayberry, who just happened to be monitoring the police scanner at that very moment, overheard officers being dispatched and quickly headed that way. Chief Ronnie Pendleton and his men hurried to the scene and secured the perimeter, where officers stayed the entirety of the night, chasing off coyotes and protecting the area from any further contamination. The next morning, as the sun was still rising, FBI agents from Abilene showed up. A couple hours later, an FBI forensic team from Dallas arrived, with Dallas County Medical Examiner Dr. Gil King in tow. After preserving and documenting the scene, Dr. King began excavating the bones. As he did, both local and federal law enforcement officials, who worked the Ryan Burton case for so long, immediately recognized the shreds of what appeared to be a nightgown as they were unearthed. They were all but certain they were looking at the body of the little girl they'd been seeking for nearly 3 years. Before the morning turned to daytime, the skeletal remains were sent to Dallas by airplane. At the Southwest Institute for Forensic Science on Saturday, June 16, 1984, Dallas County Medical Examiner Dr. Gil King and other experts worked to identify the skeletal remains of a child found the previous Thursday in Breckenridge. A photograph of 3-year-old Ryan Nicole Burton was sent in to compare with the skull's teeth and officials worked to see if there was a clear match with the girl's hair they found in the shallow grave. Ryan's teeth were unique in a few ways, including the two chipped in front. The remains were positively identified as hers. Since there were only bones, the medical examiner reported, a cause of death could not be determined, suggesting that there were no signs of fractures due to bludgeoning or nicked bones caused by a knife, for instance. Though they declined to report the estimated time of death, the fact that Ryan still wore the nightgown in which she was last seen suggested whoever took her killed her shortly after abducting her. For years, local, state, and federal investigators utilized many resources and investigated countless leads looking for Ryan Burton. Most of the investigators, like her parents, clung to the hope that she was still alive, but the terrible, tragic truth was that she laid in a shallow grave 2.5 miles from the Burton home the entire time. The day before the body was officially identified as Ryan Burton's, local authorities back in Breckenridge told Helen and Bud Burton they believed the remains belonged to their daughter. The parents, however, clung to the thread of hope that it was not Ryan. After the ruling was official, Breckenridge Police Chief Ronnie Pendleton, a Texas Ranger, and an FBI agent visited the Burton home and told them the news. Bud and Helen secluded themselves to their house after and refused to speak with the press. Instead, a relative spoke for them, describing the shock the family felt after believing beyond a shadow of a doubt that Ryan was still alive. Breckenridge Mayor Lloyd Mayberry commented that the news was nearly impossible to accept and that reporters should respect their wishes and leave them alone. When they finally released a statement, Bud Burton showed up without Helen, who, of course, was emotionally unwell. Though Bud was there, he could not speak. Lloyd Mayberry read the family statement. "Without the support and love we have received from everyone, we couldn't have made it through this long ordeal. We would also like to say thank you to the many people who took the time and cared enough to call in leads on children who they thought were Ryan. Even though they didn't turn out to be, it gave us hope and showed people were still thinking of Ryan." On Thursday, June 21, 1984, a closed, tiny white casket was positioned at the front of the Melton Funeral Home Chapel. The service was open to the public and attended by many, but the Burton family asked that the burial remain private. They also asked that memorial donations be given to Breckenridge Daycare Center. The trajectory of the Breckenridge police investigation, of course, took a major turn from missing child's case to a murder investigation. Although Chief Ronnie Pendleton said he'd had so much hope that they would find Ryan Burton alive that he shuddered to think she was in fact deceased, he also said that finding the body was the first real piece of evidence in the case. Since the police had a loose idea of what happened, old leads would be reinvestigated. Chief Pendleton went on to say that the investigation by the Southwest Institute for Forensic Science was still incomplete, and that he hoped to glean new information regarding what might have happened to Ryan as the result of further testing of the remains. Undisclosed clues found in the shallow grave gave the Breckenridge police hope that they'd soon be on the right track. They were more determined than ever to resolve the murder of this 3-year-old girl. Interestingly, the field where Ryan Burton was found almost 3 years after she went missing was said to have been thoroughly searched, though it is likely her remains had not yet been disturbed by coyotes and other wild animals. This made it entirely possible that the spot was simply looked over. Still, investigators believed that Ryan was quietly kidnapped from her crib as her 12-year-old babysitter slept, and with that belief, the most plausible theory that follows is that the person who took her was not only familiar with the Burton home, but also had knowledge that Bud and Helen Burton would be 100 miles away watching the Texas Rangers play in Arlington. This perhaps played into comments both Breckenridge Police Chief Ronnie Pendleton and Stevens County Sheriff Louis Hall made to reporters in the days following the discovery of Ryan's skeletal remains. Sheriff Hall said that there are suspects, and Chief Pendleton spoke of re-examining specific angles that were considered immediately after the three-year-old disappeared. Lloyd Mayberry was insistent the cops solve the case and catch the child murderer.
"I want them caught,"
Mayberry told a reporter.
"Everyone is real upset someone in this city is responsible for her death."
To be clear, it is unknown if any of the suspects at this point resided in Breckenridge, since police refused to divulge any information pertaining to them. But Mayberry certainly spoke for the entire town. As the shock of the discovery of the skeletal remains of little Ryan Nicole Burton faded to terminal grief for the Burton family, they believed, as did the Breckenridge police, that the person responsible for the three-year-old's death would be in the custody of authorities sooner rather than later. As the years passed, however, that optimism faded. Like it had when Ryan's disappearance was a missing child's case, the murder investigation went cold for years to come. On Thursday, June 18, 1992, at 10:55 p.m., a man jogged into the Fort Worth Police Department's downtown headquarters. The profusely sweating man approached the front desk where Officer H.L. Richardson sat and asked him for a drink and to use the bathroom. The man seemed strange and despondent, according to Officer Richardson and the Star-Telegram reporter who just happened to also be at the front desk. The man said he'd walked all the way from Columbus Avenue on Fort Worth's north side, where he was staying at Victory Mission. He told the police that he needed to confess to a mysterious kidnapping and slaying in Breckenridge.
"I need to turn myself in,"
the man later identified as 35-year-old Manuel Fernandez said.
"I killed a three-year-old girl 10 years ago."
Needless to say, this was unusual, and Officer Richardson was taken aback by the man's admission. As he described the crime, Fernandez abruptly admitted to another in the middle of his statements, the rape and shooting murder of a 7-Eleven convenience store clerk in 1982 on Fort Worth's 8th Avenue. Officer H.L. Richardson said Fernandez seemed confused and that his guilty conscience had gotten the better of him. A confession was the only thing that could alleviate that guilt, the policeman observed. Fernandez was read his Miranda rights and taken into a room. The man waived his right to have an attorney present while police questioned him about the 7-Eleven murder, which he was subsequently arrested for. Homicide Detective Danny LaRue was called downtown to speak with the confessor about the Fort Worth murder. Manuel Fernandez told police he was born in Breckenridge, but grew up in Fort Worth. At the time of Ryan Burton's disappearance, he was working for an oil well service company back in his birth town. His sister, Fernandez continued, lived across the street from the Burtons, although she would not let him stay with her while he was in town. On September 3, 1981, while Ryan's parents were away in Arlington, Fernandez snuck into the Burtons' house, slipped past the sleeping babysitter, and took the three-year-old, he told police. The date was the first of many details the man got wrong. Ryan was taken in the early morning hours of September 6th, not the 3rd. "After taking the toddler," he went on, "he tossed her in his truck like she was a doll." Fernandez said he remembered hitting Ryan Burton with his fist, but does not recall assaulting or killing her. "He drove from the Burton home to what he called a ranch," he told detectives, "and threw her out of his moving vehicle." He'd phoned Bud Burton just after he kidnapped Ryan to confess, Fernandez said, but claimed he was drunk and no one would believe him. Fernandez told detectives that he committed both crimes while extremely drunk and at a loss of control.
"I'm just an alcoholic. That's why I got into Victory Outreach. I couldn't live with something like this for the rest of my life."
The details Fernandez knew were consistent with the 7-Eleven murder, Detective LaRue later told a reporter. As the confessor was being arraigned the following morning, police from Breckenridge raced to Fort Worth to get their turn. A Tarrant County judge ordered that 35-year-old Manuel Fernandez be sent to Vernon State Hospital for 30 days since he'd been deemed incompetent to stand trial. After his time at the facility, Fernandez was considered competent, and his sobriety had him seeing things in a different light. Fernandez denied he'd abducted and murdered 3-year-old Ryan Burton and claimed he did not remember confessing to police. While a Tarrant County grand jury investigated him for the murder of a 20-year-old 7-Eleven clerk, who Fernandez said was 17 in his confession, he sat in a Tarrant County jail where he was charged with capital murder. For months, the man sat behind bars as prosecutors in Stevens County built a case to take before a grand jury. Tarrant County officials released him to Stevens County in November 1992, and on the 5th of that month, 90th District Attorney John Neal filed capital murder charges against him. The following day, a grand jury was assembled to investigate Manuel Fernandez, who had turned 36 while sitting in jail. For 5 more months, Fernandez sat in a Stevens County jail while the grand jury investigation continued. The fact that it took that long, quite frankly, is astonishing. Not only did Fernandez not have a single detail to provide to law enforcement that hadn't already been printed in the newspapers, some of the details he'd provided were simply wrong. For instance, when he confessed to Ryan's abduction, he told police he threw her out of his moving vehicle. The 3-year-old, however, had been buried in a shallow grave. Another seemingly deceptive piece of the confession was the location where the man's sister lived. Fernandez told investigators his sister was in the house across the street from the Burtons in Breckenridge, and though it's unclear if that is true or not, the fact that he also told detectives his brother lived in a house across the street from where he'd slain a woman at a 7-Eleven convenience store certainly diminished his credibility. On Monday, March 29, 1993, Manuel Fernandez was no-billed, his case dismissed by a Stevens County grand jury. The confessor had lied, they determined, or perhaps was hallucinating his confession. Whatever the case, Fernandez was not their guy. 90th District Attorney John Neal commented that though the investigation resulted in a dead end, it was not all for naught. His first goal, to solve the kidnapping and murder of Ryan Burton, was not realized, he knew, but his next goal, to get all the files, documents, and physical evidence on the 3-year-old's case back in one place, was indeed fulfilled. Neal was definitely right. Over the years, files and other evidence had been sent to the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation, and the Texas Rangers, and some of it never returned, remaining scattered for more than 12 years by the time his grand jury gathered and brought it back to Stevens County and Breckenridge Police. Plenty of witness testimony, too, was now on the record. The investigation into Manuel Fernandez was, in fact, the best opportunity to reinvestigate the abduction and slaying of Ryan Nicole Burton. Sadly, by the time Fernandez had confessed, both Helen and Bud Burton were tired and had become disillusioned with any investigation at all. Neither have spoken more than a sentence to the media in the years since, and the death of their beloved daughter and the lack of justice for her is too painful to keep going through, and they certainly have reason to believe that true justice will never be served. Here's why. Helen's boss remarked almost immediately upon news of Fernandez's confession that she did not think he was guilty. The Burtons felt, Helen's boss said, it was someone local, someone they knew. The first ever hint that the Breckenridge police had a particular suspect in mind all along. Then, more than a decade later, in 2007, a newspaper report completed Helen's thoughts, albeit vaguely. Breckenridge police, among other law enforcement jurisdictions, were all in agreement that the man responsible for kidnapping and killing little Ryan Burton was a local man well known to the family. Former Breckenridge Police Chief Ronnie Pendleton commented that within a few months of the toddler's disappearance, they'd whittled down their suspect pool to one man. Retired Texas Ranger Gene Key agreed.
It was pretty much an agreed deal. He was our suspect,
Key said. This man, who police refused to name, was the prime suspect for reasons authorities are keeping close to the chest, other than to say those reasons did not jibe with evidence. But also because alibis he provided for the time of Ryan's abduction simply did not check out. But detectives were never able to gather any evidence against him, or even a motive. The reason the Burtons feel that justice for their daughter will not come, likely, is because the man, the suspect, has since died. If you have any information about the Ryan Nicole Burton case, please call Stevens County Crime Stoppers at 877-500-TIPS or 877-500-8477. If you'd like to support Gone Cold, Texas True Crime, you can at patreon.com/gonecoldpodcast. There, you'll get the episodes ad-free, and you can even get access to several Patreon-exclusive episodes. Thank you to everyone who already donates to the show on Patreon, and thanks in advance to you future patrons. If you'd like to directly support cold case investigations that need your help, we'd appreciate that just as much. In our show notes, you'll find links to several places you can help. They are the GoFundMe campaign to help the family of Leon Lorales, whose 1996 murder is in desperate need of an outside look. Also, you'll find links to DNASolves.com, where you can donate to cases that law enforcement needs help funding. The Fort Worth Cold Case Support Group, too, could use a hand. At their website, you can donate to help our city's diligent and determined cold case detectives solve their many cases. There are some special events in the works concerning the Fort Worth Cold Case Support Group, including something specific to Gone Cold, so stay tuned for those as well. Again, you'll find links to all these incredible and important causes in the show notes. Another way you can support Gone Cold is by leaving us a 5-star rating and written review on iTunes or wherever else you listen. Those reviews help Gone Cold's visibility, which helps new listeners find us. However you support the show, we'd like to thank you. The Abilene Reporter News, the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, the Daily Oklahoman, the El Paso Times, the Orlando Sentinel, the Pensacola News, and BreckenridgeTexas.com were used as sources for this episode. Thanks for listening, y'all.